Her audience shook their heads, indicating that they could make nothing whatever of this heretical turnabout. "Would you believe," murmured Mrs. Bates, "believes in time." "It'll be for the worse," said Mrs. Fosdyke darkly. "You mark my words." "Well, anyhow, Glad, you've got that Daisy out of the 'ouse," Mrs. Bates told her friend encouragingly. "You try and look on the bright side." It was not in Mrs. Fosdyke's nature to look on the bright side, and even the departure of Daisy had not been as straightforward as it might have been. There had been certain mysterious arrangements to be made, hints of dark secrets. "You got to wait while I get things ready," she told her parents, once the purchase of the goat had been made. "I got to go in the garden, and I got to go up to Grandma's room, and I got some things to do yet. Come on, Billy Goat Gruff." She went out into the garden with a submissive Billy Goat Gruff in tow. It was hard at that moment for anybody but Mrs. Fosdyke and Mr. Bagthorpe to believe that his nature was anything but soft to the point of soppiness. The latter, realizing this, said, "If she's not back in 5 minutes, you'd better send out a search party, Russell. Even man-eating tigers stop for a breather sometimes." This remark was made partly to justify his own earlier tirade about the animal's behavior, and partly with the intention of sending Aunt Celia into a full-scale flap. It failed signally on both counts. "We are all aware, Henry, that you have no affinity whatever with animals," Grandma told him coldly, "unlike Daisy, who is a child of nature. Even the birds of the forest would fly to her bidding," cooed Aunt Celia, making her daughter sound like St. Francis of Assisi, to whom, the rest well knew, Daisy bore not even a passing resemblance. A fairly heated debate about Daisy's character then began, interrupted only by the return of its subject, beaming happily. "Everything's all right," she announced contentedly. They all assumed, mistakenly as it turned out, that she had been making a final tour of Highgate Cemetery, or paying her last respects to Arioch. "Now I got to go up to Grandma Bagg's room," she told them. "Come on, Billy Goat Gruff." "But really, Daisy dear," protested Mrs. Bagthorpe weakly, "I really do not think that the goat should be taken upstairs." "You see, Russell," said Mr. Bagthorpe delightedly, "you see now what you've got sharing hearth and home for the next God knows how many years. It is a young animal, and I have read somewhere, I think, that the life expectancy of a goat is somewhere in the region of 40 years. It will see you all into your graves, and sooner rather than later, I should guess." "Unless, of course, it gets run over in the drive," William said. Uncle Parker was well and truly caught in the crossfire. It was wonderful the way the Bagthorpes so often managed to manipulate their own disasters to encompass other people. Uncle Parker kept up his cool front, but was very unhappy. He had forked out £70 for a goat for whom, on sight, he had felt instant distaste, and it now did indeed appear that this animal was to be as inseparable from Daisy as Arioch had been. This would make life uncomfortable, almost certainly smelly, and possibly even more expensive than it had been during Arioch's regime. Mr. Bagthorpe's good humor, on the other hand, was increasing by the moment. He had rid himself of the goat at a handsome profit, secured Daisy's simultaneous departure, and was definitely one up on his old adversary. Characteristically, he could not resist rubbing salt in the wound. "Let the child take the animal upstairs," he told his wife. "Let's find out if it's house-trained, eh, Russell?" Daisy and the goat trotted out, followed by Grandma. Those in the kitchen could hear scuffling as the goat's hooves slid on the rugs on the polished floor in the hall. "It's to be hoped it's not scratching up my parquet," Mrs. Fosdyke said to Mrs. Bagthorpe, almost threateningly. "It is indeed, Mrs. Fosdyke," said Mr. Bagthorpe, forestalling his wife's reply and making this one of the rare occasions when he actually entered into any kind of direct conversation with Mrs. Fosdyke. "Fair acreage of parquet yourself, haven't you, Russell?" "Though not him that has to polish it, I dare say," said Mrs. Fosdyke sourly. "Indeed, no, there you have a point," Mr. Bagthorpe exclaimed, seizing the opportunity to inflame matters further. "Will your own housekeeper be inclined to take to the animal, Russell?" or up and leave, do you think? There can hardly be any small print in her contract relating to a goat, house-trained or otherwise. Oh, dear, said Aunt Celia faintly. Mr. Bagthorpe, satisfied, sank back into his chair. The best way to get at Uncle Parker was through Aunt Celia, who was less equipped to do her own housework than most ladies. Her fingers were long and white and tapering, though they did sometimes arrange flowers. At the Knoll, household duties of a more mundane nature were performed by a personage called Mrs. Bend, who lived not in Passingham, but a nearby village. She came in every day on a bicycle, come hell or high water, which would seem to indicate that she was made of fairly strong stuff, as indeed she needed to be, what with Daisy's writing on walls and setting fire to things in corners and experimenting with water. Life at the Knoll, as often as not, was hell and high water. It could not, Mr. Bagthorpe further reflected, be easy for this Mrs. Bend to get on to Celia's wavelength. Nobody found it easy, or possible even. Housekeepers generally like their employers to be recognizably of this world, and Mr. Bagthorpe knew that Mrs. Fosdyke, for instance, would not long tolerate an employer who was always gliding about with her eyes glazed, throwing pots, or lying in a darkened room. That Mrs. Bend did tolerate all this was a further indication that she was a lady who was not easily thrown. Most people, on the other hand, have a breaking point. Mrs. Bend's, he gleefully told himself, could well turn out to be the goat. He found himself speaking his thoughts out loud. They'll chew anything, of course, goats. They say they can go for months without food as such. They manage on things like rugs and upholstery and curtains and such. Water, that's the only thing you need to give them. You're overdoing it, Father, William said. We get the message. He was afraid that if his father needled Uncle Parker beyond endurance, the banquet could yet be cancelled. At this point, Daisy and the goat reappeared, followed by Grandma, the latter looking pleased. The animal is not house-trained, she informed the company. We discovered this on the landing. Had the discovery been made in her own room, she would presumably have looked less pleased. Mrs. Fosdyke let out an exclamation of disgust. There was nothing in the small print of her contract, either, about goats. "I'll be off now, Mrs. Bagthorpe," she said, whipping off her overall. "Dental appointment, you'll remember," scooting over toward her coat at a rate fast even by her own standards. The door had banged behind her within the minute. "I said goodbye to little Tommy," Daisy said, "and Grandma gave me this pretty box to put things in." "Lovely, darling," cooed Aunt Celia. "It is not to be a parting present," Grandma told her. "Darling Daisy and I shall keep in close touch. I have promised to report to her daily on the progress of the kitten, and have also undertaken to come over from time to time and assist her with the training of the goat." "Good idea, Mother," exclaimed Mr. Bagthorpe heartily. Grandma's influence on the goat could not be anything but bad. The goat's behavior would spiral downward at the speed of light. At this moment the telephone rang, and Jack went to answer it. He quickly reappeared. "For you," he told his mother. "Hospital." Everyone's worst fears were confirmed on Mrs. Bagthorpe's return a minute later. "Great Aunt Lucy is to be discharged tomorrow," she told everyone. "The head nurse says she is much rested and quite ready to go home." "Then they'd better put her in an ambulance and send her home," said Mr. Bagthorpe, his mood undergoing an abrupt change at this reminder of his own problems. "She need not imagine that I am driving all the way to Torquay." "But when I say home, dear, I mean here," Mrs. Bagthorpe faltered. She had meant to prepare her husband for this eventuality, but had never quite seemed to find the right moment to do so. "She will require some attention for a while to come." "Look, Laura," said her husband, "the last place anybody can look for attention of any kind is in this godforsaken household, and at the moment some of us are still sane. A few more days of kippers at the full moon and buttered scones at dawn, and we shall all require hospitalization." "But, Henry, dear, I told you, Lucy now believes in time. She believes in it implicitly." "So you say," he returned. "Even if it is true, this news is of no comfort to me whatever. Nobody round here knows Lucy like I know her. People with bees buzzing round in their bonnets like her don't change their spots overnight. If, as you maintain, she does believe in time, she will not be believing in it like any common or garden mortal. She will have spun round through a full 180 degrees like any damn politician. Which is to say, Mrs. Bagthorpe was now rather cool. Every now and again she found her husband's exaggerations intensely trying. Which is to say, continued Mr. Bagthorpe, that she will now be working to the clock like any Bolshe trade unionist. She will have armed herself with a stopwatch. She will have carved the day up into segments. She will want everything done spot on to the nearest fraction of a second. We shall all be regimented out of our minds. She will probably insist on bells being rung, like in the Navy. You'll see. There was a pause. The head nurse did say something about... Mrs. Bagthorpe's voice trailed off. About what, Laura? Mr. Bagthorpe demanded. Oh, dear. About being sure to pick her up at 11 o'clock sharp. Mr. Bagthorpe groaned.